Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Leslie Rawl. I'm from Charlotte, and I represent the appellant Tiffany Brack in this appeal. For the court to consider whether error occurred or not in this case, it needs to consider whether a North Carolina bail bondsman occupies a position of public or private trust.
Well, Ms. Rawls, it's not this error, right? We're talking about plain error, so the judge would have to be plainly wrong in order for us to change the result in this case, correct?
Judge Diaz, I believe that is correct. The two cases that were cited for the clear error standard of review in the appellant's brief did not discuss whether the defendant objected at trial. The general rule is if the defendant did not object at trial, that plain error occurred, and or that plain error must be shown for reverse. And so we proceed under the grounds that plain error is, in fact, the correct standard of review. In any event, it's necessary to look at whether or not North Carolina bail bondsmen occupy a position of public or private trust, because that was the grounds for increasing her offense level by 2 points, which put her into a different guideline range. The judge did depart upward from that, or very upward from that guideline range, but his starting point was the guideline range, and in the discussion at sentencing, he mentioned that he was considering various factors under the statute, including the guideline range, which would have been his starting point. This court has previously held that when a defendant is trusted by a victim because of the victim's credulity or the defendant's personality, that the guideline enhancement, the offense level enhancement does not apply. And in this case, the victim's credulity and the defendant's personality are the basis for that trust. The record shows that Ms. Brack pleaded guilty to having posed as a bail bondsman and then received property and funds and identity information that she used to obtain more property and services.
But in this case, the victim did not get deposited his assets with the defendant, but the fact that she acted as a bail bondsman.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the only opening that gave her the opportunity to take his funds. Is that correct?
That is correct. And yet, if a bail bondsman doesn't occupy a position of public or private trust, then the fact that an individual trusted her because she posed as a bail bondsman is insufficient for the offense level and have enhancement under the cases of Kaplinger and Bowling from this court.
I understand North Carolina law, bail bondsman functions somewhat the same way as an attorney would who receives funds through his or her escrow. They're required by law to take the property that their client gives them, place it in a segregated account, just like the trust officer or attorney in an escrow situation. Their trust accounts, their state law, would be required to do. Why doesn't that give the same standing or position of trust as it would for the attorney or the client trust officer?
Well, the opportunity to put some property in trust, it's called collateral security under the North Carolina statute, is only one facet of a possible arrangement for a bail bondsman. A bail bondsman is governed by statute. The fees are governed by statute in North Carolina. There is a 15% ceiling on the fees, 15% of the bond, so the bondsman is at risk for the remaining 85% of that bond. The 15% fee is earned immediately. It is not put into trust. So that, and again, that's a ceiling. So that a customer for a bail bondsman who is engaged in a commercial transaction, arm's length transaction, could come to one bail bondsman, and that bail bondsman chooses to charge 15%. The North Carolina jails are surrounded by bail bonding companies, and that customer could decide that they couldn't afford it and go to another. The other 85%, the bail bondsman is at risk. The bail bondsman is trusting that the defendant will appear for court. And if the defendant does not appear for court, then the bail bondsman is on the hook to the North Carolina, I think probably administrative offices of the courts for that remaining 85% of the bond.
You go into the courthouse to bail out whoever you're inclined to bail out. You get the bail bondsman in. The bail bondsman requires $10,000. You give the bail bondsman $10,000. The bail bondsman does not get to put that $10,000 into their boat payments or their bank account. They have to hold that money separate and apart.
No, sir, they don't. Your Honor, the North Carolina, there are two statutes that are relevant. 58-71-95, that North Carolina General Statute, sets the maximum amount of a bail bond. When the bailsman receives that $10,000 in your example, that's earned. That does not go into trust. The second section is 58-71-100, which applies to collateral security, and which is also mentioned in the earlier section.
The bail bondsman has $10,000.
Okay, if the bail bondsman will take the fee to begin with, under 58-71-100, if he chooses to also receive collateral security, which is not done in every case, then the statute specifically says collateral security shall be placed in trust. So that property is placed into a trust account in order. The North Carolina legislature recognizes that because the bail bondsman is on the hook for that 85% of the remaining bond, that he's taking a risk. And so the collateral security is authorized and allowed in order to protect the bail bondsman's interest in not losing that additional 85%. So if you had a $100,000 bond and he charged a $15,000 bonding fee, the bail bondsman immediately earns that $15,000 fee. It's not like attorneys who take contingent fees and then draw on the trust account. It's also distinct from attorneys because bail bondsmen are regulated in a manner that's closer to the manner in which many other professions are regulated in North Carolina. The government's brief notes that bail bondsmen are required to pass a criminal record check, to be of good moral character, and to provide fingerprints in order to be licensed. So are massage therapists, bodywork therapists, hearing aid fitters, and hearing aid sellers.
I've never heard of them receiving collateral security.
Well, they do not receive collateral security. The overarching nature of a bail bondsman is not that they receive and hold collateral security. The statute 58-71-100 allows them to do that, and it says if it's in a reasonable amount, which is undefined. But it does allow it. It does not require it, and bail bondsmen do not have to receive collateral security in every case where they bond a defendant out. Nor do bail bondsmen engage in any sort of conduct that is unique or special, such as an attorney conduct. Since you offer the example of the attorney's trust account, an individual cannot appear in court on behalf of another person just because they're a friend or a family member. They have to be licensed to practice law in that court. A bail bondsman does nothing unique. Anyone can walk into a courthouse and bond someone out of jail, or walk into the jail and bond someone out once the bond is set. A bail bondsman simply does it as a business, as a commercial transaction. So that a bail bondsman is engaged in going into court, going into the jail, getting the individual out based on his signature and a promise to be liable for the remaining 85% of the bond, actually for the 100% of the bond, they receive 15% up to 15%. They can receive as little or as much as they want. The customers of the bail bondsman can negotiate for an amount. It's not a set fee. The bail bondsman can go into the courthouse, or the jail, I'm sorry, and do the same thing that any individual off the street can do in bonding a person out. The bail bondsman is no different than someone who walks into the courthouse with a certified check or cash in order to bond someone out or the deed to their property. They're not engaging in anything that requires specialized knowledge or skill.
Well, so you indicated that at least, or conceded that at least in some circumstances, that a bail bondsman does undertake to hold in trust some collateral security. And doesn't the case law in this case simply require that the relationship in question be akin to a fiduciary relationship, not exactly on all fours, but on some of the characteristics of a fiduciary relationship? And if we have at least that, and how can we say that the trial judge plainly erred in this case in making that offer?
The nature of the relationship does not have to be on fours with a fiduciary relationship. In this particular case, it's necessary to look at the overarching nature of a bail bondsman, and including the requirements that the North Carolina legislature has put out. A bail bondsman does not engage in anything like a fiduciary relationship. And while this court has previously said that a mechanistic approach to the job description is not appropriate, and in looking at this particular case, on the facts of this case, as well as the nature of the bail bondsman, it's clear that the relationship, the trust, arises from the victim's credulity and the defendant's personality.
Let me ask you this. Even if that's true, then isn't it clear from this record that the judge was inclined to sentence at the sentence that he arrived at, irregardless of the enhancement?
No, Your Honor, because he also said that he considered the sentencing guidelines as the starting point from which to depart in sentencing at a greater sentence than what would have applied if she had been sentenced in the guideline range. So he started at a guideline range that was 9 to 11 months higher than it should have been, and went upward from that in order to punish her because she was different than other defendants. But he didn't start at the point of the actually applicable guidelines and consider under those guidelines how similarly situated defendants would have been treated. He started at a higher level. The guideline that was actually applied was 46 to 57 months, and without that two-level enhancement, it would have been 37 to 40 months.
Your argument is Harris is starting at a higher amount, lower amount, spot.
It's impossible to say he would have ended up at the same spot because he started at...
Well, I know, but under our case law, she reasonable error.
Yes, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. Yes, the argument is that it's procedurally unreasonable to start at the incorrect guideline level because it puts her at a starting point that's higher than similarly situated defendants, so that the court's decision to increase her sentence reflects a larger increase or a longer sentence than he would have considered without that procedural error.
If a family member has some child in jail and they don't have the money to bond, what alternative do they have to get the child out of jail other than go to a bond?
Assuming there are no other family member or friends who can get someone out, likely none. Or request a bond hearing, have the attorney request a bond hearing. If they have no property to put up, which I assume is correct in your question, then the bondsman is the resource. But it's the same as if you have a cavity and you need to go to a dentist to get your tooth filled.
Yeah, but you don't give the dentist extra money dependent on him returning it to you with all the conditions. In other words, this defendant took more than 15%. Under normal conditions, she would have been expected defendant appeared to court, he cloned up everything over 10 years.
I don't believe that the record actually shows what the bond was or whether the amount that she received was about 15%.
It must have been a pretty bad case. She got $16,000 in cash and 2 pieces of title and 2 pieces of property.
Well, Your Honor, it's also important to recognize the victim's credulity in the circumstances. And the FBI interview at the house shows that he was an elderly man and that he did have limited capacity, and that his granddaughter, who was the person originally in jail, actually told the FBI officers that FBI agents that she had that he had done some of the things that he didn't remember doing, such as going with her to sign the paperwork to buy the car, and going with her to buy the $1,500 chihuahua.
You've got some time remaining. Let's hear.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors, Ms. Rawl. My name is Frank Chuck, from the Middle District of North Carolina, representing the United States. Your Honors, the District Court did not commit plain error in applying the Section 3B1.1 Abuse of Trust Enhancement in the Act. From the perspective of Mr. Sapp, he had entered into a relationship with Ms. Brack initially solely as a bail bond. It was her status, her assumed status, the bail bondsman approaching someone trying to bail a loved one out of jail, that was the entryway to their relationship. The nature of a bail bondsman is a bail bondsman takes property, money, to obtain a bail bond. That was the gateway which Mr. Sapp passed through to give Ms. Bragg discretion to take his property. He thought to obtain the release of a loved one. From the perspective of the victim, it's very clear from the circuit's case law, this court has ruled repeatedly that the abuse of trust enhancement must be taken from the perspective of the victim. Here, the victim was a person attempting to bail out a loved one, his granddaughter, who was approached by Ms. Brack, who portrayed herself as a bail bondsman, discussed the bond with him, and asked for specific property for the purpose, stated purpose, of helping him bond out his granddaughter. So the entire nature of this relationship is that of a professional relationship between a bail bondsman and a person seeking to help their loved one. And this is where, in my brief, the government brief, we distinguished the Kaplinger case. Ms. Brack relies on the Kaplinger case to try to set this relationship aside. But in Kaplinger, the defendant was also operating under a ruse. He pretended to be a physician. Who was particularly skilled. He, in fact, claimed to be the runner-up for the Nobel Prize in Medicine. He provided information that encouraged investors to invest in a ruse scheme involving a quote miracle drug. But this court focused in on an interesting point in his relationship. He was not did not have the relationship of trust of a physician to a patient. He was not in a trust relationship with any of the investors who was providing information. Here, Ms. Brack entered into a trust relationship, assumed client relationship with Mr. Sapp. Therefore, unlike Kaplinger, she had the direct relationship with Mr. Sapp. And the government would argue that, in fact, reviewing the statutes and North Carolina law and the nature of a bail bond, that a bail bondsman does have some of the aspects of a future trustee. This court's rulings, which are cited in the brief, make it clear that the term abuse of trust ties into some of the aspects of a fiduciary or a trustee. As has already been discussed in this hearing, but in some situations, bail bondsmen accept collateral. They're required by North Carolina General Statute 58-71-100 to place such collateral in a trust like I'll note
let me ask you about that statute. Is that the amount of money over and above the normal fee, or is that the fee all the money?
That regards to collateral security, I think, Your Honor, that there could be a situation almost like a flat fee for an attorney, where there's a fee that's up front that's simply already an earned fee. However, where further collateral is taken, there's a clear mandate by the Carolina statute that a trust account be maintained, that a receipt be provided by the bail bondsman, that the property be placed in the trust account within 2 business days. The very essence of being a bail bondsman is to handle money on behalf of clients, to help secure a bond. Bail bondsman take collateral property. And that goes back to the nature of this relationship. Mr. Sapp gave her quitclaim deeds of his property because she was presenting herself as a bail bond. He thought he was engaged in the professional relationship that would allow him to provide property to secure the release of his granddaughter.
So that may have been the case with respect to at least the beginning of the relationship, but the appellant also presented in her brief facts and to show that the relationship then morphed into something else. And there was additional property that was taken that had nothing at all to do with the bail bondsman relationship. Is that at all legally significant?
I would agree those are facts, Your Honor, that at some point, and I think it's where the Land Rover, that sort of property question, I noted that in my brief, that at that point it's not clear why he signed the Land Rover. Perhaps our talking to daddy or granddaddy. It's not legally significant, Your Honor, because gateway. For even to be at that point, Ms. Brack has to enter into a relationship. The beginning of that relationship is her approach to Mr. Sapp as a bail bond within the jail. So the initial provision of property, the money, the identifying information, which is really an important part of the case, looking at the money and collateral, identifying information, then you need to get lines of credit to buy dogs and have cosmetic surgery. So without the initial trust relationship, she would not have contact with him that would allow this relationship to exist in the first place. So
your position is we would make the determination as to whether or not a position of trust existed at that initial time of the initial, not at some later point.
Yes, Your Honor. There is some point, Your Honor, that toward the end of the relationship where there's some unclarity why he's given her, why they she's all that far. Now, of course, she has his identifying information because
it is either a position of trust at that initial payment or not.
Yes, Your Honor, and it is a position of trust. Let me be very clear. The government is arguing that there is a position of trust. It's that of a bail bondsman. That is why she gave him his identifying information, bulk of the property, and that is the only reason Mr. Sapp has a relationship with Ms. Brack. That took part early on as part of the bond relationship. Ms. Sapp to Ms. Brack represented falsely to Mr. Sapp that the bond, that she needed their prom with the bond and she needed further collateral and that she could get to use her bank right now. She then, of course, used it to sell the home without Sapp. So that was part of the trust relationship. That was him providing property to her in an attempt to achieve the release of the grant. So that was definitely part of the relationship with the trust that they failed on.
So your position would be that the record supports the conclusion that the transfer of the real estate occurred prior to the transition of the relationship.
Yes, Ron, I think the record directly reflects that. She asked for that because of her problems with the bond. Ms. Pratt made various statements when she sat about the bond being large, the problems with the bond, the property was turned over directly to her. That was part of that. There is no relationship here. You are strangers outside of Ms. Pratt, trust Mr. Sapp, a point of vulnerability. That his perspective allowed him in the process to give her property use on his behalf. And it's clear from the record that Ms. Pratt's own statements to police that she made the approach to represent herself as a wife, bail bond, and got the information, the money, and the property. At some point later in the relationship, there's some type of uncertainty. I think the record is clear, it's not certainty regardless. But without without that abuse of trust relationship, without that bail bonds relationship, client relationship, that's the great gateway. Puts them together, and the record is very clear. The majority of the property, certainly the identifying information, is provided as part of that relationship. And I want to stress from the perspective of the issue, from the perspective of the victim, he is at a county jail, trying to seek release of a loved one, approached by a woman who speaks about bond, speaks the lingo of the bail bondsman, who represents herself as a licensed bail bond, and then, as would be expected, ask for property to help secure it.
Was there any evidence in the record that he expected to get any of his money back to be all turned off?
The record, I think, is clear, Your Honor. He expected that money to be used. There's nothing in the record that says he expected it directly, but it's clear from the record he expected the property to be used to obtain a bond. So implicit in that, Your Honor, would be the fact that the money would come back to be obtained a bond that she would release and take the money they would return to collateral. Certainly,
and she showed up.
Correct, and she complied with the return. Certainly, the record would certainly show that he provided the property as collateral for a bond, not for any other purpose. And as long as she complied, property was released as collateral. Certainly, I think it's very clear from the record he did not intend to have Ms. Brandt exploit that position, clear out his bank account. Mr. Sapp made brief statements at sentencing. They're worth reviewing, Your Honors. He basically said, took all my money, cleared out my account. That was not his intention. He would never have given her that money except for the fact that he did, except for the fact that she presented herself as a bail bond. He certainly never would have given her the property, his house, and other property he bought their name in collateral.
Yeah, I'm thinking the pre-sentence report is characterized as collateral.
Yes, sir. And Your Honors, of course, if any further questions. Thank you.
Ms. Rawls.
With regard to the Kaplinger case, the government submits that the distinguishing factor is whether the defendant had direct contact with the victim or not. In fact, in Kaplinger, the Fourth Circuit said that the distinction was the nature of the expected trust. In Kaplinger, as Mr. Chutt noted, the defendant posed as a learned doctor who was marketing a new drug and developing a drug that would treat diseases that were previously considered untreatable. The opinion in that case discusses the fact that you don't rely on your doctor generally for investment advice, and that is what he was offering. The key point in Kaplinger is not that the investment company owners relied on the doctor and their investors did not. The key factor in Kaplinger is if he was a doctor and you don't go to your doctor for investment advice as a general rule. Kaplinger is also important
for the...
Because Kaplinger also illustrates that it's not simply the perspective of the victim that matters. Because in Kaplinger, the victim of the fraud relied on this particular doctor, thought he had invented the medicine or had access to the invention of a medicine that would cure incurable diseases. From their perspective, he was trustworthy.
But he didn't want to establish this by every fraud risk, certainly. So I thought the decision happened was that there was no position of trust obtained by acting as the physician or the victims, whether or not his patients. But in this case, the only relationship parties came about because of the bail bond situation. That was why the victim in this case was accepted.
Yes, Your Honor. And in Kaplinger, the perspective of the victims would have been the same as Mr. Schaaf, in the sense that the victims would have relied on information that came from that doctor. And the nature of a doctor advising about investments is not a relationship of trust. And in the same way, the bail bondsman, despite the fact that Mr. Schaaf relied on the representations of Ms. Brack with regard to the bond, the need for collateral property, and so forth, the perspective of the victim is not the only thing that controls. Victims in every fraud case believe that they can trust the person who's perpetrating the fraud. It's the nature of the case. And Kaplinger, in addition to standing for different matters, also stands for the principle that it's not perspective of the victim that controls in that sense. With regard to the nature of fees taken by bail bondsmen, some of the questions from the court during Mr. Chutt's argument suggest that there may be a need for clarification. So if that's correct, then I thought I would address that as well. There are two types of bonds, fees for bail bondsmen authorized by statute. The first is that bond fee of up to 15%, and that is distinct from the collateral security section. And the statutes that are cited in the brief address that. If the court doesn't have any other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rawls. I know that you're court appointed, and we appreciate very much your accepting the service. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our next case.